Welcome back to Extinction or Internationalism with MIT Professor Emeritus Noam Chomsky and actor Wallace Shawn. Mr. Shawn started the conversation.
You've laid out so much, it's hard to know where to begin. I think I will ask maybe a silly question. Most of the people in this room care about the future of the planet, human beings. I think the first thing that we could do, if we could, to preserve humanity would be to convince the people who aren't in the room to care. Is it that they don't know that these dangers are very real, or is it that they don't have the ability to care that much about things that are intangible?
Take a look at just the examples that I mentioned and ask yourselves, not the unwashed masses out there. So, for example, there was a great furor for years about the so-called Iranian nuclear threat. There's one very simple way to deal with it, very simple. Institute a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, okay? Verifiable nuclear weapons-free zone, as there are in other areas. Would that be hard to convince Iran to agree to? No, they were leading the effort to institute it. Would it be hard to convince the Arab states of the region? No, they had been forcefully advocating it for over 20 years. In fact, they're the ones who insisted that unless this is done, they're going to pull out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, destroying it. The United States and Britain, as I mentioned, had a unique commitment to this because of the resolution that they appealed to when they invented a pretext for invading Iraq, which committed themselves to this. How many people know that? How many people know that this Iranian nuclear crisis could have been overcome, whatever the crisis was, very easily? No threats of war, you know, no negotiations, no sanctions. Just agree to institute a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. I mean, you can't do it just by clicking your fingers, but it's obvious how to do it. It has been done elsewhere. Nobody knows, so you can't be committed to it. If people knew and they were committed to it, they might have compelled the United States, President Obama, to withdraw the U.S. opposition, which blocks it regularly, most recently by Obama in 2015. If you read professional arms control journals, you know about this. And you also know what's obvious on the face of it, that the United States is blocking this and indeed imperiling the Non-Proliferation Treaty because it doesn't want Israel's nuclear weapons to be inspected. Well, is that interesting? Would people care about that when their lives depend on it? I suspect so. Or take, for example, what's happening right at this moment. As I mentioned, the United Nations, for the first time, is considering a resolution backed by major states, Brazil, Austria, others, probably going to get the votes of at least 120 countries, calling for a treaty that declares these horrible devices illegal and demands their elimination. Of course, the United States is not going to vote for it unless there is popular pressure to do so. But there can't be popular pressures unless people at least know it's happening. And this goes case by case, all through these matters. The fate of NATO, what NATO was about, why it's expanding, why not accept Gorbachev's vision of a peaceful, integrated Eurasian security system with no military blocs. People can't press that unless they know. Or take this leaked private conversation of Hillary Clinton and a number of funders recently. I think it came from WikiLeaks, published in the New York Times. Clinton took some pretty reasonable positions, like any politician, adjusting to the audience that she was speaking to, who happened to be powerful people but opposed to nuclear weapons. And what she said was, we should reconsider Obama's $1 trillion modernization program, and we should oppose the development of the most dangerous parts of it, the ones I mentioned. That's called small nuclear weapons, which means huge ones, cruise missiles with nuclear warheads that have the dangerous capacity that you can scale them down to actual battlefield use, which means that an officer in the field whose forces are in danger, say, could decide to use tactical nuclear weapons, which explodes very quickly into terminal nuclear war. So she said she's against it, and we should reconsider the modernization program. When she talks to the next audience, she wasn't going to say that. But it could happen if people organized and mobilized to keep her feet to the fire. Say, okay, nice comments, stick to them. That can be done, but only if you're aware of it, and secondly, if you're willing to become active and engaged. Otherwise, it's frittered away like many other opportunities.
When you speak of activism, first you're speaking of spreading awareness. Why is it that the regular media, the New York Times, whatever, is so reluctant to write about these things in a way that would enable activism to reach more people?
I mean, there are a lot of reasons. It's not necessarily bad faith. If any of you went to journalism school, you know that one of the things that's taught and very highly respected is a concept called objectivity. And objectivity has a meaning. It means reporting accurately and fairly what's going on inside the Beltway, White House and Congress. You report that accurately and honestly. So if Donald Trump tweeted some obscenity at 3 a.m., it's the lead story in the New York Times. And if Clinton said, whatever she said, that's a big story. But if anything isn't being discussed within the narrow political economic establishment, you're not supposed to report it. That would be biased. It would be emotional. You know, there's all kind of terms for it. It's not being objective. And that's a doctrine of journalism. And if you think it's very different in the academic world, you're not wrong. I mean, it's a little different. So for example, the article in International Security that I mentioned, which is extremely significant. You look at the archival research, it's reported there in a rather dry way, but if you read it, what it says is George Bush, number one, the judicious Bush, and James Baker were purposely deceiving Gorbachev when they told him that NATO was not going to expand to East Germany. They were doing it in a way which would be purposely deceptive, so that instead of dismantling NATO and accepting the vision of a world free of military blocs, we would be expanding NATO soon up to the Russian border, with consequences that we see right now. So it's there, but not there in a way which even the academic world sees. I mean, somebody might look at the article and say, yeah, kind of nice, and go on to the next article. You have to find the things that matter and bring them to public awareness. They're not hidden. It's a very free country. Things are open, find out a lot of things, but it's not handed to you on a silver platter. That's what activism is about.
What do you think of civil disobedience, chaining yourself to things and going to jail, and is that?
I myself have been involved in it many times, been in and out of jail a lot of times, faced a long jail sentence and so on. So I think it's a legitimate tactic, but the ways in which it is conducted, in my opinion, often aren't legitimate. it's often conducted as a kind of a statement of personal conscience. I'm going to take the risk because of my conscience, for some, my relation to God or something, whatever the consequences. And I don't think that's the right way. Civil disobedience makes sense if it brings to other people a recognition that there's something serious enough for some people to take risks, and maybe they should think about it and go on and do something themselves. If the groundwork is laid, then civil disobedience can be an effective tool. If there's no groundwork, it's just not. It's harmful, in fact. And I should say this includes acts of people I very much respect and admire, close friends. So, for example, when peace activists break into a submarine base and bang missile nose cones without any preparation, the net effect is to anger the workers, why are you taking away our jobs, to anger other people, why are you getting in our way and annoying us, what's the point? Just because it makes you feel good? That's not the right kind of civil disobedience. That has arisen many times. Any of you who've been involved in activism over the years know very well that these questions constantly arise. So it's pretty dramatic, for example, during the Vietnam War. I mean, I remember discussions with Vietnamese right at the peak of the war in which they were talking about the kind of actions that they wanted to see. And they would give examples like a group of women standing silently at the graves of American soldiers. That they really respected. And when you brought that to American activists, they just laughed. A lot of young people wanted to go down Main Street and break windows to show how much we hate the war, which of course just builds up support for the war. The Vietnamese wanted survival. They didn't care if people felt good. And those are questions that constantly have to be asked, all the time. You have to ask, what are the likely consequences of my act? Whether it makes you feel good is not relevant. In fact, negative. Yeah.
Many of the people who do know about the consequences of nuclear war and climate change are quite well-educated people who are resented by a lot of people. Do you have any thoughts on how, I mean, there's a class difference. The Trump supporters who laugh at the idea of climate change have a built-in resentment against people who've been well-educated and who may be better off economically. How do we
it's serious.
Communicate with
That's
them?
That's a very interesting phenomenon. It has to be dealt with sensitively and with understanding. So as I mentioned, 40% of the population say it can't be a problem because of the second coming. Now that's a deep cultural problem in the United States. It's very important to realize that this country was a cultural backwater until the Second World War. You wanted to study physics, you went to Germany. You want to become a writer, an artist, you go to Paris. There were exceptions, of course, but it was overwhelmingly true. And it was true, although the United States was far and away the richest and most powerful country in the world, and had been for a long time. All kind of historical reasons for that. It's a very insular country. There aren't many countries where you can travel 3,000 miles and be in about the same place where you left, not running into any different culture or language, anything like that. And protected by oceans, we keep away from those bad guys. Enormous internal resources, which nobody else had. So there are a lot of reasons for it, but it's there, and you can't ignore it. And there's no point railing about new atheism. These are issues that have to be understood. and has to be understood that the churches really mean something to people. Plenty of people, including the Trump supporters, these are people who've just been cast aside. Nobody does anything for them. The Democrats abandoned the working class decades ago. Republicans talk a line, but they're much more opposed to working people than even the Democrats in policies. You know, working class males are, we're supposed to call them middle class in the United States. The phrase working class is a four-letter word here. We're all middle class, but working class males who are supporting Trump are actually supporting policies which are going to devastate them. Just take a look at the economic policies, the fiscal policies and others. But it's true that they're cast aside and their values are being attacked. Their values are in many ways culturally traditional and pre-modern in the Western sense, but they're being attacked. And one of the few refuges they have is the church. They have the church and the traditional community. So you can't just laugh at it. It's serious. It has to be dealt with. There's a very interesting book that just came out by Arlie Hochschild, a sociologist who went to a relatively poor area in Louisiana and lived there for 6 years and studied the people sympathetically. This is deep Trump country. And her results are quite interesting. So, for example, these are people who are being devastated by chemical and other pollution from the petrochemical industry. But they're strongly opposed to the Environmental Protection Agency. And when she asks why, they have reasons. They say, look, what's the Environmental Protection Agency? It's some guy from the city with a PhD who comes out here and tells me I can't fish. But he doesn't go after the petrochemical industries. So who wants them, you know? I don't want them taking away my job and telling what I can do and speaking to me with their cultivated accents while meanwhile I'm under attack by all this stuff. And those attitudes are all the way through. They're serious, they're significant, they deserve respect, not ridicule, and I think they can be addressed. For example, I think that, say, in the 1930s, I'm old enough to remember, in many ways it was kind of like now. Poverty was much greater. The depression was much worse than the current recession. In fact, a much poorer country than it is now. But it was very hopeful. My own family, many of them were unemployed working class. Most workers were unemployed. But they were hopeful. They had a sense that things are going to get better. There's militant labor action, the CIO's organizing, there were left political parties, the unions were providing real services, a couple of weeks in the country, educational groups, workers' education, ways for people to get together, and somehow we'll get out of all this. That's lacking. It's become a very atomized society. People are alone with used to be their TV sets, now it's their cell phones or iPhones or whatever. Very atomized, isolated, makes you feel very vulnerable. And these are the kinds of things that can be overcome by organization and activism. And my own feeling is that the Trump supporters and the Sanders supporters could have been a unified bloc with proper approaches to the problem, which take effort and sensitivity and understanding. So it's easy, say, to have cartoons about Trump and how ridiculous it is, but that's missing the point. Maybe it looks ridiculous, but he's reaching people for reasons, and we should be interested in the reasons. Actually, it's the same story, to turn to something else, with young Muslims in the West who are joining the jihadi movements. It's not enough to scream at them. There are reasons. And if you look at the circumstances of their lives, you can see the reasons, and they can be addressed.
And so, really, activism, ideally, would start with a compassionate traveling into these unknown territories of our own land that Hochschild went into. I mean, really, what we can do in Boston and New York is less important than what we might be able to do if we went to Louisiana and moved there for a significant period of time.
I don't think we have to go many miles to find this. So for example, a couple of years ago, I happened to be asked to give a talk at a high school in downtown Boston. It's called English High School. I think the reason is because nobody there speaks English. There's maybe a dozen languages with different immigrant groups. And it's a very activist community. There are local activists who are discussing the kind of work that they do there. And it's important and interesting right here, Boston. I mean, people feel it's helpless. We can't do anything. How can we fight these big powers? And some of the things that were described, I think were very instructive for me. I think they would be for all of us. So for example, get together a group of mothers who want to have a traffic light at a street that their kids have to cross when they go to school. So they organize, leaflet, talk to the local representatives, other things. Finally, they get their traffic light. That's empowering. That tells you can do something. We're not alone. We can do other things. And then you go on from there. That's how things develop. And yeah, Louisiana, but not far from home either. That's right exactly where we live.
Yeah, we're obliged to talk. It's a serious responsibility to talk to the guy sitting next to you. It isn't usually known. Now, I've been asked on this piece of paper that it's to ask the audience if we have questions. We have a couple of microphones that people could go to.
Audience members then queued up to three different question mics. Some identified themselves, while others spoke anonymously.
Hi, my name is Emily. I work with 350 Mass. And as someone who works a lot on climate change, I think a lot about overcoming despair. And the picture you've painted tonight is pretty bleak. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on how we sustain hope and commitment in the face of that.
It's pretty easy, actually. Just think of the alternative. Suppose you don't keep up your spirits and you let it happen. What's the world going to look like? Well, there won't be any organized human life around. And most other species will be destroyed. Is that the world we want? Does that keep your spirits up? I mean, if you have the choice, the other does.
Hi, I'm Jason Framus with the Boston Institute for Nonprofit Journalism. And Professor Chomsky, understanding that the main push for banning nuclear weapons has to take place on the national and international stages, do you think it would be useful to organize for city, state, and regional nuclear weapons-free zones, including provisions that would ban nuclear weapons research and development at schools like MIT and related research institutes like Draper Lab? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of an analog to nuclear weapons-free zones. It can be done locally, too. And banning nuclear weapons research is very important. Incidentally, at MIT, the story's a little different. There was, if you're interested, this issue was brought up by activist students, quite rightly, during the period of major activism in the late 60s. And the outcome was kind of interesting. There was confrontations building up. It finally led to the usual thing, a commission, faculty-student commission. I was on it, actually, Pound's commission. You can read its report if you like, which investigated military work on campus, not nuclear. There was no nuclear weapons work, but military work on campus, okay? And it was pretty serious then because the Institute was maybe 90% funded by the Pentagon, so it was a natural question. And the results were interesting. On campus, there was no classified work and no military work. Off campus, there were two laboratories Lincoln Labs and what's now called Draper Labs. That's about 50% of the whole budget, roughly. And they were doing military work off campus. Off campus is a little bit of a formalism. Nothing stops people from attending seminars across the street, but they were technically separate. Actually, the only military work going on campus, which was not investigated, incidentally, because it wasn't a science department, was the political science department, which actually was doing effectively counterinsurgency research in Vietnam. They didn't call it that. It was called the Peace Research Institute, naturally. but it amounted to counterinsurgency studies in Vietnam. But that was about it. There was a debate in the commission as to how to deal with it. Sort of more, you know, roughly speaking, conservatives, liberals, radicals, two of us. The conservatives said they wanted to keep it the way it is. The liberals said, we want to make a break. Keep the military labs off campus. The few radicals agreed with the conservatives. We should keep it on campus, so it's a constant source of activism and education, not formally remove it where you can pretend it doesn't exist. Well, the liberal opinion won, so they're technically off campus. Actually, other questions have arisen too. Take Iranian nuclear weapons. It's a very interesting story. I kind of mentioned it. In the 70s, when Iran was an ally, in fact, the main U.S. ally in the Middle East, Guardian of the Gulf, it was called, there was strong pressure from Rumsfeld, Cheney, Kissinger, and others on MIT particularly to invite Iranian nuclear engineers to study nuclear engineering at MIT. We didn't know at the time what we should have known and know now, that the Iranian government was openly declaring its intention to develop nuclear weapons. It's hard to believe that Kissinger and those guys didn't know, but wasn't public knowledge. There was a turmoil on campus, which was pretty interesting. Students began to mobilize about it. There was finally a student referendum where I think my recollection is long, I may have the numbers wrong, so this is rough. My recollection is about 80% of the students wanted to prevent it. It became a big enough issue so that there was a huge faculty meeting. People usually don't go to faculty meetings, they're too boring. But when there's a big issue, everybody comes. So the huge faculty meeting, big debate, there were maybe five of us who agreed with the students. Overwhelmingly, the faculty disagreed and said should keep it on campus, which is kind of interesting if you think about it, because the faculty are the students of 10 years earlier. But just that institutional change led to a dramatic change of attitudes, and not because of more information. Faculty didn't have any more information than the students did. It's kind of an interesting example. Most of people like us should think about it, of how our institutional role influences the way we look at the world. Well, it went through, and the people running the Iranian nuclear system, many of them were trained at MIT.
There's a lot of talk these days about lesser evil voting and choosing the candidate who's most likely to get elected, but inflict the least amount of harm. And I'm wondering, isn't a vote for the lesser evil, whoever it may be, just a vote to perpetuate the two-party system that's led us down the road we're on today?
Well, maybe half the population abstains. I mean, are they changing the system? No, they're having no effect. Lesser evil, there's a lot of confusion about lesser evil voting. The point is really trivial. It's a point of logic, simple logic. If you happen to be in a swing state, let's say you have to make a decision who you think is the worst candidate, okay? Okay, suppose you've decided you think Trump is the worst candidate. same if you think Clinton's the worst candidate. But let's say you suppose Trump's the worst candidate. You have a very simple choice. Am I going to vote for Trump or am I going to vote against Trump? And if you don't vote, you're voting for Trump. And if you vote for a third party, you're voting for Trump. That's arithmetic, and you can't argue with arithmetic. If you take one vote away from, say, Clinton, it's equivalent to adding one vote to Trump. So one thing we can't argue about is arithmetic, okay? So that much is clear. What you can say is not clear is who's the worst candidate, okay? That you can debate. I frankly don't think it's much of a debate, but you can decide. But those are two separate issues. And in all of this furor about lesser evil voting, all the articles you read, you'll notice they're constantly confused. If you separate them, it's all straightforward. You find who's the worst candidate, you decide whether you want to vote for them. And in a swing state, voting, say, for a third party is voting for the worst evil. That's logic. Can't handle that. About not supporting the two-party system, by abstaining, you're not changing the two-party system. You could be changing it by working to develop, first of all, for working within it, like the Sanders movement, to try to change and modify it, which can be done, and in fact already was done even by the Sanders movement. The current Democratic program is probably the most progressive in decades since the New Deal. It won't be enacted unless there's pressure, but that's what political action is. The other possibility is actually developing a third party. And developing a third party doesn't mean just showing up every 4 years and running somebody for president. That doesn't do anything. What you have to do is constant activism, starting at a local level. You know, elect people to school boards, town councils, state legislators, all the time, you know. That way you can develop the basis for a third party. Now, in our political system, which we inherited from England, there's a barrier against third parties. We inherited a first-past-the-post system. Countries with proportional representation, there's many more opportunities to develop independent parties. So one option is to move towards a proportional representation system. Another option is to use the mechanisms that are within the two-party system that allow for the development of independent parties, like fusion candidates. So the Working People's Party in New York, you can vote for them, and that helps build the party, but the votes go to usually the Democrats. Okay, that's a way of working within the system. But the possibilities are work to develop a meaningful third party, work to change the existing parties, but just staying away from it doesn't help. Half the population does that anyway. Actually, it's an interesting half the population. There's a very interesting study, revealing study, about early Reagan years, early 80s, by Walter Dean Burnham. He's very good scholar who studies electoral politics. He did, as far as I know, the only study of the non-voters asking what their socioeconomic profiles were. That was a pretty interesting result. It turned out to be pretty similar to the people in Europe who vote for social democratic or labor-based parties. Here, they just don't vote. Now, that tells you something significant. Incidentally, that wouldn't be true today because the social democratic and labor-based parties in Europe have collapsed.
They've said that was the last question.
Oh.
The higher authorities, that we must come to an end tonight. So
a beginning.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody.
Extinction or Internationalism? Prospects for Survival with Justice. A talk by Noam Chomsky and Wallace Shawn, held at the Old South Church in Boston on October 19, 2016. This program was presented by the Wallace Action Fund. Special thanks to Freeman Z for technical support with the audio recording. This program was mixed and edited by your radio host, Chuck Rosina. Thanks for listening.